ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Colonel Carlos Vega, a senior Army aviator and the chief of staff for the Army Cyber Institute. Before taking up his current position, he served in multiple leadership roles in the Army. His initial assignments, located at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, included a support and flight platoon leader, flight operations officer, and aviation planner. As a captain, he served as a logistics and budget officer at Fort Rucker, Alabama, where he commanded a company of instructor pilots and trained aviators from Latin America in their native Spanish language. As a major, he served as the chief information officer for the U.S. Army forces in South Korea, where he integrated information systems to support operations on the peninsula. As a lieutenant colonel, he served as the chief of cyber operations for the 18th Airborne Corps, Fort Bragg. These duties and responsibilities included Chief of Information Assurance, Network Defense, Network Engineering, and Services, as well as the Integration Officer. In this capacity, he was the Chief Communications Planner for the Pre-Deployment Site Survey Team for the Corps' final mission in Iraq in 2010. Colonel Vega is a graduate of the Aviation Officer Basic and Advanced Courses, the Combined Armed Services Staff School, the Command and General Staff College. He holds ratings in the UH-1 Huey and the UH-60 Black Hawk and completed the UH-60 Instructor Pilot Course as well as the Airborne and Air Assault Schools. He's now president of the West Point chapter of the Military Cyber Professionals Association and teaches in the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at the United States Military Academy in West Point, New York. His current research interests are in network analysis as well as information sharing in complex, multinodal organizations. Through his research, he seeks to apply mass collaboration to enhance information sharing between U.S. Army units and partner organizations. Colonel Vega, thank you so much for joining us today. We usually speak with people who are working in entertainment and media-related industries, but one of the things we're currently grappling with as an industry is rapid disruptive change. And operating in this environment, there are a lot of legacy organizations, and the people in these organizations are under a lot of pressure. And so I thought it would be really interesting is to dive into a conversation with you around leadership, and specifically leadership in a when you're in a legacy organization in a rapidly changing environment, where the stakes for failure are high. So in a lot of corporate structures, there's a lot of hierarchy and stakeholders want to weigh in on matters, but that means decision making can be slow and slow can be problematic. So can you talk to me a little bit about how you've put together your organization and how what that meant, what had to change in culturally, in your organization?
Sure. So first of all, I'm with the Army Cyber Institute. It's a relatively new initiative within the Army. It started in 2012 with a decision to create the Institute, and then we had to rapidly form, organize, and create not only a mission, a vision, but some objectives, and bring the right people in to build the organization. This is unprecedented on how fast we had to create this organization, in the sense that the Army has been around for quite some time. Collectively, it's over 1 million people. But here we are in a time where forces are shrinking and we're expanding. So there really is not a large appetite to create something new. But the environment that we're in is cyber. So we do cyber security and do research in cyber defense and some of the interesting things that deal with the discipline and the domain of cyber. So with that backdrop, we created this organization. So how did we put it together and what were some of the challenges? So first of all, I mentioned one already. There wasn't an appetite to create a new organization and to do something new. So one of the key things to the project when we started was to identify who our champion was. Because that champion had to be someone who was going to enable us to overcome whatever barriers we encountered. In this case here, it was the Chief of Staff of the Army, General Odierno. And his input or his guidance to us was, come up with a plan, and I will be the one who will tell you yes or no on whether you can do it or not. What that did for us is that provided us the top cover to really explore what the realm of the possible could be. And that allowed us to look into different ways that we could address this challenge that we are experiencing in cyber. So the key thing there is that we had a significant champion, and that champion also resourced us in the sense, when we talk about leadership in the military, we often go to certain principles, and those principles, every soldier learns them. And one of them has to do with mass and economy of force, or two of them, mass and economy of force. Mass has to do with committing all the resources necessary to really accomplish what you're trying to do. In other words, don't hold back. If this is important, then apply all the resources necessary to make it important so that you're not set up for failure to begin with. Mm-hmm. Now, its counterpart is the economy of force, meaning you can't do everything all the time, every time. So you have to really have an appetite suppressant on where you where you really are not going to get everything you want. So as you develop your plan, one of the challenges is to identify where you absolutely need to put the most resources, and the other is where you don't. Mm-hmm. And then really that's a balance between the two. You can't talk about one without accounting for the other. Mm-hmm. But again, the big champion, that's what really helps with everything, because they're the ones who determine whether you're going to get resourced or not.
Well, at what point did you then have to go back? How did you have to say, so he said, do this, and then you come up with, how much were you checking in? Did you say, okay, these are what we've ID'd as the needs. This is what we've ID'd as the resources. And these are the things that we're going to let fall off the plate because they're not as critical. Did you then have him sign off on that, or how far did you blow it out? How much lead and head were you able to have in building the organization?
We did check in quite a bit. There were a lot of checks and balances. What we call it is an ATMOS check, is where are you going, and is that the place that where your sponsor or your organization wants you to go? So it's getting a lot of feedback in the process. So we immediately created a structure that was approximately 25 people to really lead this charge of research and this brain trust for the Army in this cyber discipline and domain. And we submitted that as a plan. Mm-hmm. And the chief at that time, General Dierno, came back and gave us an azimuth check. And he said, I don't think you understand what I want. Mm-hmm. And he said, you're not thinking big enough. I really want you to lean forward. And at that time, he unleashed any constraints that we had. And some of those were restraints or constraints that we put on ourselves because we thought, no way is he going to let us do this.
Right.
But then when he said, he gave us the authority, and he presented us with a vision of what he wanted. He didn't tell us how to do it. He just gave us an idea of what he wanted, and we had to go figure that out. So what we started with was something very reserved. What we ended with was something very robust.
Right.
And we're still growing to this day.
So is that core of 25 people to put together the plan, would you say that's an optimal number of people to achieve? It's large enough to have a diverse number of diverse backgrounds and inputs, but not so large as to be unwieldy. Why 25?
So we had four main objectives that we were trying to accomplish. And we focused on the one that we were comfortable with. And that had to do, most of us came from an academic institution at West Point of teaching and doing research in this discipline. And that's what we focused on. We've assumed that he came to us for a reason, because we're really good at this. Mm-hmm. So let's increase the size of a few people to, 10 times more than what we originally had. And he said to us that is not what I want you to do. Mm. I picked you because you were being innovative and you were doing something that nobody else was doing. But instead, I want you to focus on this bigger mission. And that mission had less to do with teaching and more to do with educating a greater population, both inside the Army and outside the Army, and informing them on the critical issues that we're facing with regards to cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we realized that we really had to bring in other specialties that were not traditionally in this arena. And that is where our numbers began to grow significantly more than when we had originally planned. What the right number was for that, that's a long process that the Army goes through to do that. But basically what we found is we identified some of the key tasks, and if we had to do it right to get these tasks completed, what is the right mass that we need to do that? The overwhelming number of people, specialties, capabilities to be decisive in that task that we have. And then we looked at back to the economy of force is where can we really leverage other people to do things for us where we don't have to use all of our resources to do that. And that's one of the aspects that we realized is that to be really good at this, it's not just what we bring to the table, it's what the others who are left and right of us, the knowledge, skills, and abilities that they bring to this challenge that we're facing. And in that case, those others were not just within the Army or within the Department of Defense, but it was the private sector and academia, other institutions, other research groups, and experts who are already doing this in other communities.
I see. So this is you establish it in 2012, and now it's end of 2016. You're up and running. I imagine things change pretty rapidly. How do you move with speed? How do you keep on your mission, keep everybody who needs to be informed, without finding yourself constantly in meetings? And how do you delegate a lot? Is it around kind of having mission clarity and pushing things down? Can you describe a bit about how you can rapidly keep up with the times, but still keep everybody informed as needed?
Sure. Again, this goes back to some of the very principles that every Army officer gets taught, with some basic fundamental principles that apply both to our business of warfare, but also business and other arenas. So one of them is to keep the plan simple. It is make it clear, uncomplicated, and concise on what we want you to do. And that's what General Odierno provided to us. This is what I want you to do. I don't want you to do that. I want you to do more of this. Mm-hmm. And it was very clear. Also, we weren't sure exactly how we were going to do everything and what the exact outcomes would be. So what we empowered the team to do is to have a clear objective. And that is to say, some people call it a vision. Some people call it a mission. We call it commander's intent. If you were at the end of the day, how would you define whether you were successful or not? What is that metric for success? So that was clear. And then we empowered and resourced the individuals to go out there and accomplish that mission or that task. Some failed. In this arena that we were in, that is okay. But what we also encouraged them to do is to move out fast and fail quickly, so we could learn our lessons from that and apply that to whatever else we're going to do, and then we can reassign and readjust. So there's in other words, don't put more resources to something that is going to fail in a year from now, and we can determine if it's going to fail in a few days or a month.
Does the commander's intent, having that metric for success, is that so fine that it's constantly being redone, or is it... are there multiple metrics? Achieving clarity around that. I mean, I think that that's something that I know certainly some of the clients I've worked with, I've had conversations with them, and I've said, do you know what successful is? Do you know what you're trying to achieve? And sometimes they don't. They don't in their own careers, and they don't necessarily with even the brief that we are given, which then makes it very challenging to help them achieve it, because how can you achieve something that you don't know? There isn't a target. How do you know if you're going to hit it? So how fine and how often is it redone, this commander's intent?
You know, that's a very good question. And there's a lot of different disciplines that ask or address that issue specifically. And so I'll turn to my software engineering background of validation versus verification. The difference between the two, it's quite simple when you break it down. One of them is, did you do it right? The other is, did you do the right thing? Mm. And those can be competing.
Right.
So someone can do exactly what you told them to do. They followed the rules or the instructions just as you explained them, but that is not really what you wanted them to do. They didn't get the commander's intent, and that's the validation that you did the right thing. Mm-hmm. And that's often the rules or the instructions can actually be very limiting. So I would tell you that they're not changed very often when the task is determined because it's not that explicit.
Ah, okay. Right.
It's not that explicit. It's more of a vision, more of when everything else we planned and there are no further instructions, what are you going to do?
Right.
And in the absence of guidance, in the absence of leadership from external leadership, in the absence of anything else, I know what I have to do to be successful.
Right. Right. Well, I think another thing that you had mentioned when we spoke earlier was about you're not the only one writing your story. In searching for your magic solution, the landscape is always changing and your enemy also has a part in the narrative and they're changing the environment. So everything is in a state of change. So for a media company, you know, looking for that perfect solution, the disruptors have a voice and you don't even know what they are going to do. There's some parallels there as well. So in this situation where you have the commander's intent and you empower people to move forward rapidly. If they fail, it's a data point and then they move on. How does feedback get given then in such a way as to help people understand what was successful, what was failure, or is it manifestly obvious to everybody?
Well, we often want to prepare our future in a manner that I can start doing things that will influence my outcomes. If I perceive something that is going to happen in the future, and I'm not talking about a visionary type environment or situation, but I'm talking more if you know what the outcomes are going to be, and if I prepare and do things today, when I experience that outcome, I am shaping what my options are, what my courses of action are. So what we often try to do is we try to shape the environment and shape what our future will look like so that we're not surprised by it.
Right.
Otherwise, our future is going to be a surprise every day.
Right.
But we already know that. We already anticipate that. And we do that in everyday life already. But now we got to do this more strategically. So what do we do to prepare for that? We look at our plans that are out there and we look at our worst possible scenario. What can happen there? If that happens, I'm going to have to do a few different things, A, B, C, or D. A more likely scenario is going to be this. And if that occurs, I'm going to have to do A, B, C, or D. And then there's another scenario that you can think of. And you start comparing what these different scenarios could be. And that's when you start to plan. And you start to anticipate resources you're going to need. And you start to anticipate what you may need to do to prepare, to inform, to train, and to really get your team together for that unity of command, as is having a common objective, a common understanding with one clear leader to help direct the team and resource the team. But the idea is that the future is going to come whether we like it or not. But we do have the ability to shape what that future will be. And we do that by preparing for something, just like we prepare for an exam. That test is going to come. It's going to be really hard and we're going to fail, or it's going to be really easy and we're going to succeed. It is not an independent action. It has to do with your preparedness for that event. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is we collectively, not just my vision, but we sit there as a group and we divide the teams up and we say, okay, I want you to all come up with different courses of action and consider the worst case scenario, the best case scenario, and the most likely scenario. Mm-hmm. And then we put all these things together and then we make plans for all of them. And what we end up doing is a hybrid of all of them. But when something that we didn't expect pops up, we likely planned for it already in one of those wargaming situations that we discussed. And it might not have been any value at the time, but now we have already thought that through and we know what to do when the situation presents itself. So the idea of shaping your future is a reality. It is something that we do. And again, we do it all the time already, but we don't really look at it in this context.
Right, right. So to draw parallels with entertainment companies, it's about looking at the landscape and seizing opportunities that may be there, being the first mover, and then exploiting that position once you have it, I would think. One of just pivoting a bit now, we spoke when we met before the interview, we spoke a bit about the strength of weak ties, and I found that a very interesting concept. Would you mind giving me a little shorthand and describe that to the listeners and what that means?
Sure. So the concept of strength of weak ties has to do with being able to take advantage or benefit from not just the people that you know, but the people that they know. So the idea of, for instance, getting a job, you're going to go to your social network to get a job. You're probably going to be very limited in your reach with regards to that, because with your network, you probably are already in the job or they already know what you're doing. And so you would have already exploited that. You would already have taken advantage of that. But the weak ties are the network that your colleagues that they reach out to. So it's the network that's one off from yours.
Right.
One of the things that I learned here by working in New York City is, you know, when someone is exercising their network for you, when they tell you, "I know a guy."
Yeah.
That is him exercising his network, which that is your weak tie to that network. The strong tie is your buddy. The weak tie are the others that are beyond that. But you'll find that is very powerful. Somebody who knows somebody.
Right. Well, and that and how information flows, and that's how things sort of virally spread. Right. That's almost the way gossip, because everybody knows the gossip who's tight. But the people who it becomes very interesting to are the ones who are maybe one remove. And for marketing people, what's interesting is then thinking about, we have these almost formalized social networks, platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, I guess. Well, just
right.
the various social platforms where you have, within that, you may have both your weak ties and your strong ties. And how then information will spread across that. And in a promotion, if you're promoting content or trying to get the word out, people will talk about viral campaigns. Oh, it was all over Instagram and Snapchat and Facebook, and look how successful it was. And we can always identify things backwards. It's easy to say that was viral, that was successful. It's harder to create, and you can even identify that they all share certain characteristics, but sometimes things share those characteristics and don't go viral. So understanding why things spread is interesting. And have you, in some of the research that you're doing with the different...
So it's basically social networks. And one of the aspects of that, I'll share a story with a colleague that we were working with from Peppercom, Steve Cody, and he leads a media firm in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about how we're going to shape our organization. And he started explaining to us in his terms what our message should be.
Mm-hmm.
And as he's explaining to it, he's saying it has to be very clear, very concise. And then he used a few different terms that really brought it home. He said, you have to hear it, you have to see it, and you have to feel it. Now, where is all that going here? Went back to what we learned in the military. And that goes to shaping your future, shaping the environment. So you have to get that message, and you have to make it very simple, that anybody could understand it, and not only could understand it, but they can also share it for you. So they're not having to interpret something for you and then get it wrong. So you want to keep a very clear message and keep it very simple. But to Cody's point, or Steve Cody's point, is you have to be able to hear it, see it, and feel it. So when someone else is telling your story or giving your soundbite on what it is you're trying to do or what it is you're trying to accomplish, you are giving them the tools by shaping that discussion. And so when you're using or exercising that social network or those weak ties that we talked about, when you ask your friend who knows somebody, you want to share with that person, this is what I want you to share about me. There's a lot of things about me that you can share, but this is the message that I want you to
share. But not that other thing.
That's right. We're not going to focus. We're not even going to talk about those other things that I don't want you to share.
Those will not be part of the conversation. Fantastic. And then the last thing I want to touch on, because I know I'm using up a lot of your time, is we've started to hear around about the edges of the conversations with other media people about the Internet of Things. And I'm sure that we're just beginning to hear about it, but this is probably something that you've been thinking about a bit more because of what your, you know, area of expertise is. And do you have any thoughts about how that's shaping up and what as consumers should be thinking about when they are thinking about the Internet of Things? Are there things that companies and consumers should be thinking about in terms of privacy and security and awareness about those things?
There's actually quite a bit, and we can probably have a whole nother discussion just on that. I'll just share a few of my thoughts on that. So the Internet of Things is here. It's already here, and it's growing. And we are not going to put any of that back in the box. The box, the Pandora's box has been opened, and it is out there. The idea of us, of the information that we're sharing on a daily basis, on a minute-by-minute basis, on a every footstep you're taking basis, is already occurring. And the fact that these devices and our information infrastructure is facilitating that, that's one of those things that I would say just is. That is the new reality. So we have to perhaps modify our behavior and recognize that while that is a very positive thing, just like you're using your map application as you're driving through the city to find the quickest route, and it's literally giving you turn-by-turn direction because it knows exactly where you are and where you're going, and it's monitoring everyone else around you. And the way it's getting that data is through this Internet of Things that we just described. And I don't want to describe it as if it's a bad thing or a good thing.
Right. It's value neutral. It's how it's used, right?
Exactly. It's who's using it and what are they using it for. Now, can somebody use it for very bad things? Yes. Can somebody use it for very good things? Yes. It got me to the airport, though.
That's how I got around L.A. So I like
that. That's right. That's right.
But there's a certain amount of exposure, too, right? I mean, how porous and vulnerable are these things?
Well, it's one of the things that we talk about on how porous and vulnerable they are. That's some of them. It's by design. Mm-hmm. It is not faulty software. It's not misconfigured or poorly designed. It's designed to track what you're doing and why you're doing it. Again, I'm using the analogy of using a direction finding capability on your phone as you're maneuvering through a city, whether you're on foot, whether you're in the subway, or whether you're driving. It wants to know where you're at, and you want it to know where you're at. And everything is working exactly as it's supposed to. Mm-hmm. But let's just say you're trying to not be tracked. You would have to change your behavior. Right. You have to turn all of those things off. Anything to connect you to the outside world, you may have to turn all that off for that period of time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we do. When we want silence, when we want to be able to work, we turn everything off. But the reality is this interconnected world that we're in, our dependency on these connections is only growing.
Right.
So you're not going to see it necessarily go away. But one of the challenges of the future, again, this is a discussion that we can have in greater length, is how is our culture going to change? How are we going to behave knowing that we are completely traceable, trackable? Where we go, what we do is now going to be transparent to anybody.
Right. To your point, it is, there's a value neutral and it's all what you do with it. Thank you so much, Colonel Vega, for spending time with us and talking about how leadership in a rapidly changing environment is executed. So thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it too. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Colonel Carlos Vega. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week right here on Up Next.